Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Heretic Hammer podcast. I'm your host, Marshall, and this is my co-host, Dylan.
Hello, hello.
And today, talking about bugs.
Woo!
Yeah, the never-ending swarm.
Creepy
crawlies. The hive mind. The Zergs. Which, I will note that there was a comment very... honestly, very kindly and very correctly posted the real story amongst why that whole myth existed.
It's true.
In our tier list episode. I did obviously say in the video that it is a myth, but then we continued to meme. So it's always good to have somebody make clarifications like that in case somebody were to go to comments and be like, this is wrong. It's like, because I can say, like, I said it was a myth, but... someone saying, like, laying it down very clearly is actually very nice. So, yeah shout out to that. However, the Zerg-like faction of 40K is today, and they are called the Tyranids, though. But it's going to kind of be actually a two-for-one today. That's due to both a problem and a solution in a way. The problem being that Tyranids have no lore at all.
Sorry, what?
They have, like, no lore outside of, like, just, like, the things of, like, how they work and, like, their general structure. But what we do get, the Tyranid lore we do get is in the other faction, the other game faction that will be bundled into this episode called the Gene Stealer Cults.
I've heard that before.
Yes. They are unequivocally tied together. That's the big thing. Which obviously I'll explain how that's the case. But since they're so, it was one of those things where I was thinking about it and I'm like, I could obviously make two shorter episodes, which, because Gene Stealer Cults have books, they do have that benefit. But I felt honestly that it ended up being making more sense to just have them tied together. So start off. Let's talk about what are the Tyranids. This is where you ask, what are the Tyranids?
Well, I'm just waiting for you to tell me.
that was all part of the bit.
Breath.
That was all part of the bit. As is very clear when looking at them, the Tyranids are, this is a Tyranid. No, wait, hold on. No, sorry, that's Matara. That's Matara. That's a VTuber. These are no, it's still Matara. That's just her as a Tyranid. Here, this is a Tyranid.
Oh God. Okay. Yeesh. Jump scared me there.
It just flashbanged you.
Yeah. Wow.
Matara flashbang. It's actually, that joke even works so much more now that she's gotten herself kind of into Warhammer. So no, these are Tyranids. They're your bug-like kind of war creatures. The Tyranids themselves, outside of obviously their buggy nature, are a very simple creature. And in fact, maybe outside of the orcs, arguments could be made for the orcs, arguments can be made against, but many would say honestly that the Tyranids are the only faction in 40K that is explicitly not evil. Because to be evil, it requires you to do all of these things, anything that you do, all these actions, killing, killing, eating, destroying. Being evil stems from, many would argue, the idea of having that malicious intent. But Tyranids do not have malicious intent. What they have is hungry intent. The Tyranids explicitly sustain themselves off of biomass. Not only biomass, but the DNA of biological creatures. You have to think of it this way. Is the cheetah evil for going and killing, its prey? No, it's its urge. It's its primal desire. The Tyranids are the same. they have many ways of going about this that still fit very 40K. Mm-hmm. But that is their nature. They are not a society or a governance, you know, like something like, you know, a Leagues of Votan or, you know, an Imperium. They are not even like the orcs, because the orcs still take pleasure in the act of killing, and they're aware that they are not only killing and potentially innocent and, you know, defenseless people, but taking pleasure in that fact. So many would argue that's what would make them evil. Mm. But Tyranids don't have that pleasure. They don't feel those emotions. Now, the other main factor of the Tyranids is that they are a hive mind. They are all uniquely connected jointly by this mysterious psychic presence that is just out in this far-flung universe, controls the Tyranids in a way to, you know, guide them forward to continue to consume and search for biomass and, you know, find new prey. But not only that, but for it to take all the information from this DNA, because it's not explicitly, and that's the thing, is it's not honestly even explicitly a hive mind in the sense of like one brain controlling multiple things. It's just they are all like each individual Tyranid and all of the DNA that they have through them, that they have gathered through millions and millions of species that they've wiped out, all kind of coalesces into this gigantic pool of knowledge that is just equally shared amongst all Tyranids. There is, if anything, one segment of the Tyranid hive fleet that is conceivably evil. And that'll be part of the first step of any invasion for that matter, but especially a Tyranid invasion. And that is their reconnaissance phase. Now, this often may start with a couple ways. One of the first, most common ones is a group of Ripper swarms will kind of escape out into a planet, essentially kind of discover and find any random life forms. So the biggest thing that these kind of get benefit on is their ability to not only burrow into the ground and be able to kind of be relatively incognito when needed, but they just look like tiny little bugs. The hive fleet and the hive mind is smart. Because this is a big thing, is that obviously as being a group of bugs, they kind of get the bad rap of being kind of looked at as a bunch of big, stupid bugs that just want to eat. Like all they want is to eat, nothing else. Just eat, 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 eat. But they're not. They're intelligent. The hive mind is very intelligent, and it is very sensible to battle tactics, to, you know, espionage, and ways to manipulate societies. And speaking of manipulating societies, that goes into our second form of reconnaissance type, which is to utilize a gene stealer. These will often then be sent to the worlds that end up being, especially those who are populated, well populated by sentient life forms. So especially like Imperial worlds, you know, possibly even like, you know, an Eldar world could technically even fall to this prey somewhat, you know, like any world that has, you know, some type of like, you know, humanoid-esque life form or sentient life form. Mm-hmm. And especially with the gene stealer cults, as they will begin to form, the general perspective gets put into Imperial worlds in that regard, and where kind of most of that information comes in. But as I'm alluding to, the gene stealer's main job is to infiltrate the society. So they have a very strong psychic connection. And one of the first things that they will do is they will find a leader, or, you know, it's not even just, not like a main leader. Like, they're not going to just target, you know, the highest noble of a planetary system or a city. They start smaller. They look for somebody that's, you know, potentially, you know, can be kind of a leader of like a small group, of a workers guild, of, you know, a factory floor, like somebody who's in charge of those. And they'll give them what's called the Gene Stealer's Kiss, which, you know, with that tongue, the Gene Simmons-esque tongue, that would seem like it could be pretty.
Beat me to the joke by seconds.
Once they receive their Gene Simmons kiss, they begin to change. They begin to almost kind of lose their original kind of thoughts and minds, and kind of begin to blend with the hive mind. And in that, that will begin to spread. That leader will bring other people to receive the Gene Stealer's kiss. And more will grow until there's a small sect of these. They'll start off just kind of balding humans, right? And they, you know, will kind of begin to showcase some of their signs. They'll be this kind of tyranny kind of snaky symbol, usually, right? Is where you'll see it. It'll kind of be these small plots, and they'll maybe, you know, they'll kind of build up, maybe test the waters, like small revolt here, small revolt there, maybe, you know, a worker strike, stuff like that. Just kind of test how they're doing and their numbers. And then, you know, they'll go through a bunch of this, that, and another thing. And then eventually, as they continue to grow and grow, one of the biggest things that they will attempt to find is a psyker. And with that psyker, they will then create a magus. And this magus or magus is beneficial, especially to helping control, keep good psychic connection and control with the other Gene Stealer cult members. But another important aspect is for them to not only be kind of almost the brood mother of these Gene Stealer cults, but it is specifically then with the kind of mind melding with not only the regular people, but especially the magus, to then breed more members of the Gene Stealer cult, kind of create more and more of these Gene Stealer human hybrids. Now, where are we at? This does not always go cleanly. This actually starts off generally with these very kind of abomination looking creatures called Abominants. And now often they will be kept because they're good, strong muscle, and you can obviously always have good use of them, you know, but eventually they refine more and more until they still maintain a pretty human looking, you know, exterior, but maybe then, yeah, they'll start getting the extra mutations, like an extra limb, you know, couple limbs. You know, they'll kind of begin to form that like hard kind of carapace-y kind of tyrannid mark on their forehead. You know, like I said before, they'll all have lost their hair, you know, but they will still, the goal is to get as many of them to still look as human as possible. You know, it's easy to explain like, oh, I just have a weird mark on my forehead. You know, I was just born with it. But it's a lot harder to explain maybe why you have, you know, two heads, kind of like an extra head growing out of another one. Or especially to start with, why do you have four arms? You know, in the Imperium, you'll get killed for that.
Hey, Teague, me and the boys are on the water cooler. We're wondering, you know, where'd you, since when did you have five arms and three eyes? Oh, you know, it's a birthmark. You sure? You right. Sure on that?
Exactly. So, yeah, they have to have a number of human-looking members so that they can infiltrate and continue to build and try to gain more and more of an army until they can eventually revolt. And thus, as a result, generally gene stealer cults will have this very Mad Max-y design to a lot of their models and pieces and vehicles and stuff like that, because they are just kind of your general person in a hive city. And honestly, the way people look, and even though they're in an actual city and civilization, most people in a hive city probably would look a lot more like the people in Mad Max than the nobles in the higher parts of the Imperium. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, but that's obviously kind of part into their design. But yeah, you will get members who will utilize a fair amount of psychic powers, whether that be the Magus themselves or amplifying kind of, you know, psychic, sonic, you know, kind of like attacks. So essentially like the equivalents of like a thunder attack in D&D. You know, otherwise they'll just have like, you know, they'll have the weapons at their disposal. So like if they take over a mining colony, you know, they'll have their pickaxes, they'll have drilling equipment, you know, their guns are going to be the normalest stubbers that you can find in the Imperium. They're not going to have bolt guns with them, you know. They barely may even have las guns unless they've infiltrated members of the guard, you know. But like there won't be many of them who just have your like almost normal looking 21st century looking of a gun as you could potentially get, maybe just a little steampunky, you know. So that is kind of dependent then, right? So as successful or unsuccessful as that goes, right, the whole idea is that with this large group, it's just constantly beckoning to the hive mind. Come to us. This is your beacon. We are here. There's life forms here. And honestly, the gene stealer mainly just cares creating as much unrest as possible. They're not necessarily concerned about fully taking over the planet. They just want to disrupt defenses, resources, anything as humanly possible. Essentially, just soften the planet, weaken it as much as possible so that when the fleet comes, it is ready for conquest, for consumption. The second type of scouting unit that kind of is to the size and format of the gene stealer, but with a different concept, is the lictor. The lictor.
Interesting.
Yeah. The lictor is a stealth hunter. It is there to find, it usually is going to be around, you know, your death world, something with like a heavy jungle, something that may have a lot of biolife form, but not a lot of sentient life form. Maybe it has one imperial outpost. Maybe, you know, it has a small society, you know, or it's an agri world, right? And what it will do instead is utilize a more psychic and emotional approach to their preparations.
Do they talk?
So, no, but what they can do, like it's, the only one that honestly probably is closest to talking is the gene stealer, but that's mostly through a psychic connection, right? A voice in your, it's kind of like where they'll try to make it so that your own mind is trying to tell you, I should go to this place. I should do this thing.
Sure.
I have a calling, you know, my conscience is telling me.
You really need White Castle at 2 a.m. You really do. You should go right now.
you really need to get White Castle. No weird adventure will happen with your friend Kumar.
You left the keys out for yourself 2 hours ago. Look, they're right there.
The Lictor is going to use stealth so it can fully camouflage itself. And the important thing... Sorry.
I was going to ask if it can turn invisible.
Pretty much. I mean, it's like full chameleon... Or like, you know, not real chameleon, but like the chameleon well, that everybody thinks a chameleon can be.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like how when people are like, "I have chameleon armor," and then they go straight up invisible, but there's like the warbliness, you know?
Right.
You know, like this very much. Yeah, the Lictor is very much akin to Predator, right? You know, maybe without the gadgets, but like very much with. Everything else, the somewhat like kind of, you know, heat-based vision, the ability to fully cloak, and will just stalk and hunt an enemy. And the thing about the Lictor that to me is kind of the coolest thing about the Lictor is, you know, you'll see them being noted as, you know, people seeing, you know, that, you know, there is more than one Lictor and all that, like, from a technical sense, right? Because, like, of course, if somebody kills a Lictor, or there's likely more than one Lictor on different planets, but conceptually, there is one Lictor. Because every Lictor is connected. Every Lictor has the experiences and thoughts of every Lictor that came before it.
Kind of a Yoshimitsu thing going on.
Exactly. The Lictor is the Lictor. There is not Lictors. There is just the Lictor. And the Lictor is very important to not only then continue to push through, you know, and hunt down, but when the reason they are hunting down these individual life forms is they are trying to absorb their memories, find out information where if, you know, because if there's a fortress, you know, if this is still a well-guarded planet, but maybe it's not a hive city, right? Well, where, so like where, you know, where, what are the codes to access the place? Or what are the weak points that the hive fleet can come in and not be seen, or, you know, and have more scout units come in, or the small chaff units kind of come in and then, you know, arise in a surprising fashion. That's what they're looking for. They're all looking for these different pieces to push the invasion forward, to help it be successful. And this is honestly probably the easiest preventative measure life form to... I shouldn't say it's the easiest. If you were to find out you had a Lictor and you killed that Lictor, right? You know... If you were on an Imperial world, right, you probably have delayed the Hive invasion way longer than if you, like, found the Gene Stealer and killed them, but it was, like, later on, so they already had a bunch of cult members.
Mm-hmm.
And especially Amagus, you know, because now generally the Gene Stealer cults can't survive without a Gene Stealer. But there's kind of always these aspects of, like, likely if they got rid of the Gene Stealer, some of its remnant effects would still be felt because of the hybrid DNA and the already connected measure to the hive mind. And then they would try to just get a, you know, they'd probably just try to send another Gene Stealer into, like, to the planet. If they don't have another one already, you know? Mm-hmm. Whereas the Lictor... is the Lictor. It's alone. So once you kill it, its connection to the rest of the Hive fleet is cut off. So that, in that respect, it's possibly the easiest preventative measure is to just kill a Lictor because it's the only one you kind of worry about.
Yeah.
But once the invasion is somewhat kind of set its teeth into a planet, right? The Ripper swarms have gone through. A Gelan Sealer cult has been found. The Lictor has been able to get some of its kind of early portion, you know, communicate and get its early portions of the hive to the planet. You'll begin to kind of, it'll seep into the planet ground level. So you'll kind of see these strange plants form. You know, the planet will kind of have these like kind of pustule portions of ground, these very chitinous, you know, almost they're essentially trees will spawn from the ground and create these kind of spine looking like spires. And these two connect to the hive mind and continue to kind of bait further in the planet. But they are also beginning one big function, and that is beginning to change the atmosphere. They are attempting to turn it from the normal, you know, likely, you know, nitrogen-based or oxygen-based, you know, air that the life forms sustain on, and essentially flipping it so that it becomes toxic. Deteriorating the air quality, you know, over time, just essentially almost even drive them further insane. And the way I'm going to continue describing this hive invasion, this is in the scenario that, like, this hive invasion goes perfectly, right? Because there's a bunch of things that can happen that can disrupt a hive fleet invasion, but they still show up anyway. You just don't maybe get, like, the air quality isn't as bad as if it, you know, was allowed to fester, or there's not as many gene stealers, or the Lictor was killed, stuff like that. But it's easier to describe this in, like, a perfect scenario for the Tyranids. But yeah, so these life forms will go through, which is great bait for Lictor, by the way, is if they try to remove the portions of the ground to, you know, like, eliminate whatever grossness is, you know, out there. Great aspect for a Lictor to go on, because they're not going to send an army to do that if they don't know what it is, you know?
Yeah.
But then the day comes, which will be one of two things. So if it's Gene Sealer Cult Planet, you'll get your Day of Ascension, which is also a book by Adrian Tchaikovsky. And that'll be the day where there's the largest scale revolt of the Gene Sealers, essentially finally going for that big preparation to fully destabilize the planet for the Tyranid invasion. And so there's a couple steps to said Tyranid invasion. So the first things you'll see coming out onto the planet will be your smaller units. So the two most common are going to be your Termagants and your Hormagants.
Adorable.
Which are your smaller, you know, massive horde, you know, just amounts of units. You know, when you look at the Space Marine 2 trailer and you see just those gigantic swarms going on and around buildings, and you're just kind of shooting and it's just a blanket of just like blood and like white bony bug looking things. It's these guys.
I love Digimon.
Yeah. I was going to say, this is potentially the first question that you or any viewer who's not really seen the Tyranids before may I ask, Marshall, why do the bugs have guns?
Thank you. That is actually, as a matter of fact, the question I was going to ask. Why do they have a gun that is connected to them, but also is in the shape of a gun?
Yes. So, I'll answer the obvious part of it first. They have they have ranged weapons for the reason that anybody would have ranged weapons. And obviously theirs is going to be made from their ammo is going to be bioorganic. So there's a couple of types of ways that these ammunitions will be utilized. With the Termagants especially, what they'll actually be is they'll shoot tiny little worm-like bugs. And when they fire into something, they will instead, if they fire into somebody without armor, it will burrow into their body. They'll burrow into their body and immediately just dig up to their brain, just shut it down. Very agonizing fashion. Or if they are armored, they'll essentially squirm around on the armor trying to find any hole that they can in order to get into the body and then thus go to brain.
Delicioso.
Yeah. Others will just utilize acid, you know, things that will just kind of straight up just melt, you know, metals, biomaterial, anything it can. Why are they shaped like guns? I have tried to find this answer in so many lore videos. And my only honest answer and thought process is the thing that I come up with as my kind of headcanon reason is that through all of the through all the sentient creatures that utilized ranged weaponry, that or at least maybe most of the creatures that they've killed that utilized ranged weaponry, it seems to be the case, at least in the world, in the universe of Warhammer, that all creatures, no matter what species they are, eventually get to gun. And so they, when they consumed the DNA and minds of all those creatures, and they're like, we need to develop, like we need to, you know, evolve ourselves into a way that we have a ranged capacity that we can shoot projectiles at an enemy to better fight them. And their memory, essentially their coded DNA memory, probably had most of the information being gun. So you'll notice with the Termagant where like their hands are almost built into the gun. And yeah, like,
that's what's so wild, you know, about it. It could have just been an arm cannon like Mega Man has, you know?
Right. And that's something you'll actually even honestly see in some of these, where these bigger ones where they'll almost have like part of their face or arm is just straight up a cannon.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I'm just trying to find another one. Yeah. Like, I think the reason, though, that I've kind of, especially the only reason I can think of as to why it's that way, again, outside of the idea of just it's Warhammer and they thought it looked cool, would be that most of the, you know, types of advanced sentient species that used ranged weaponry inevitably got to the point where they had a gun. So what became the most prominent, successful form of ranged weaponry, and that's the other thing, right? They probably saw that gun was more effective than bow and arrow,
mm-hmm,
or sling, that they were probably like, what we're going to do is we'll model our ranged weaponry off of that. What we have taken from other beings, we will evolve to mimic that. Because the reality is, the whole gun is essentially its own organism, right? And it's housing other organisms that it shoots. So it's only shaped like that just because of the, my guess being, the evolutionary data that it stems from.
Yeah.
They essentially know the most successful ranged weaponry are shaped like this. So they evolved their ranged tendrils to look like this, to look like gun. That's my headcanon reason. I don't know that that's true, but it's the one that makes the most sense to me, because there's no earthly other explanation that I can find that tells me why Tyranids have to look like gun. I know why they have gun. I don't know why they look like gun. Or, for example, why do they have to carry a sword? Their arm could just be a sword.
Yeah, how do you not just go to arm blades and have that be the natural evolution?
Correct. I don't have an answer for that one. That still eludes me, and I don't have a good reason for it. Obviously, yes, they've denoted an arm blade, like a Hormagon. An arm blade seems to be pretty effective at melee combat.
Look at that. There you go.
And it's not like the Tyranids don't have multiple arms. Like, the bigger Tyranids don't have multiple arms to help themselves.
Yeah, you don't need all of those arms to do accounting, you know? One of them can be an arm blade.
Right. Like you can still grab all the other things that you're trying to eat and kill with your three other, with even with two other arms, and still have two arm blades if you wanted. Why they are still actually swords that can conceivably be dropped, I don't know. And I have no earthly answer for. It's gonna just stick with rule of cool, and that's pretty much where that's gonna live. I can lore logic the grim derp of, you know, Tyranid gun. I cannot grim derp lore logic why a Tyranid would have just an actual sword. You know, not an arm blade, but just a straight up sword. Normal sword. Mm-hmm. You know, or like normal looking sword. It's obviously not made of steel, but that then obviously kind of will bring us into the next phase, which they'll bring in the bigger Tyranids. So your Tyranid primes, the, you know, Tyranids that are going to, you know, kind of bring more damage to whatever the siege needs, right? Break into locations, blast through doors, walls, or take care of these gigantic, chunky space marines that keep shooting down all of our Termagants and Horomagants. So another one of these types of Tyranids that you'll end up finding either on land or especially maybe even in space through boarding actions and whatnot are what's called a Carnifax. And there's actually a relatively well-known Carnifax. It's one of the few only named characters of the Tyranids. They obviously didn't name themselves. This was named by Imperial, like the, you know, Imperial warriors and stuff. But it was a Carnifax that specifically found its way into multiple battlefields against the Imperium, and that was one by the name of Old One Eye. He was part of, we'll get into some of the high fleets in a moment, but he was part of a high fleet called Behemoth, which is why he has these red and black coloring. And he's distinctly known for the kind of disfigured mark on his face. Generally, you know, kind of part of that multiple dealings with the Imperium. Otherwise, you'll further move down to greater units like a Tyrannothex, which has this gigantic cannon gun looking thing. You know, and for when it gets close, you know, it's got these pointy steppers.
Tell me that just shoots tennis balls.
In a way, except they're entirely acid and will melt anything. Excellent. That it comes into contact with. But in a way, they'll look like tennis balls on the way out. And then you'll get, you know, your larger Tyranid warriors, and then specifically then your Hive Tyrants. Now, these will come with either wings or not wings, but they are going to be your, you know, your hulking kind of leader units in the Tyranids. They are going to be some of the larger ones, and they will just blast through the battlefield if they can. And otherwise, some of the continuing moving on through more and more bigger units and continuing through the invasion, you will have your psychic based units. Many of them will be led by either neurothropes, which will not only utilize psychic powers as it is, but they will help facilitate a special effect that constantly is going over the battlefield from the moment the Hive Fleet arrives in this system, called the Shadow of the Warp. Ooh. And that is essentially this feeling over the planet where they are effectively, the Tyranids have so much psychic potential in many ways that they're actually able to completely cloud the warp. And so when they encompass over a planet, they will actually sever its connection to it. So wow. All the psychers on the planet will very much lose their minds. And those who aren't psychers, but every human especially is still attached to the, you know, the warp one way or another, they will you know, just have this eerie, hopeless feeling, you know. And they will continue to facilitate that on the battlefield by, again, pressuring through. Not only by their existence being on the battlefield, but they will also help, you know, continue to push the connection to the units on the ground to still connect very well to the high fleet. And then on top of that, they will just unleash psychic waves and projectiles at enemies that just kill them directly. Otherwise, you'll get your big tank-like units and things like the Exocrine, which, again, shoot that very, like, almost kind of plasmid, plasma-y kind of acidic projectiles and just in a much larger and more damaging fashion, for sure, in this scenario. And so at the heart of every invasion, you will then have your full-on Nord Queen. Or Norn Queen, sorry.
I was about to say Skyrim belongs to the Nords. Yeah. Not the Tyranids.
The Norn Queen always, no matter what, throughout the invasion, stays in space. And is attached into essentially a mothership that that psychically guides the Tyranid invasion as it goes through. It is the essentially main connection to the rest of the hive mind. So the thing that can happen is because the Tyranids do have spaceships in a way, you know, they're also creatures. There's a picture, you can see them in the background actually in one of these. Yeah, these. You know, they're essentially just like these creatures that go through space and they're, you know, holding the Tyranids and whatnot in them. Or they will just like birth them as they come down to the planet. But, you know, they have the capacity and will, you know, defend and fight in space. And that's the thing, is Imperial, or really anybody that's fighting the Tyranids that knows about them, they'll try to find and locate this queen's ship. Because if you can find the Norn Queen and destroy them, you effectively will completely destroy the invasion. Because the death of a Norn Queen can have so much destruction. It creates almost this like psychic nuclear bomb in space. And it said it can be felt through almost all of the nearby galaxies.
Wow.
It is incredibly powerful in its both destruction and its power amongst the entirety of the hive mind. But, you know, they are effectively the wombs of the Tyranids. So they are incredibly important to not only protect, but sustain the hive. But say you don't kill that Norn Queen and your planet is taken over. What now? Well, I got really bad news for those people who were part of the Gene Stealer cults and thought they were fighting for their four-armed emperor that was going to come bring them salvation. That connection to the hive mind, that thing that kind of, you know, shifted you into thinking you were doing something good, and all those people and potentially friends that you killed to, you know, bring forward the four-armed emperor.
Mm-hmm.
That turns off. And you are left with nothing but being surrounded by bugs that will now bring you into the feeding pits.
Oh.
And these feeding pits are not what you may think they are. You may think that they're like holes that have other little tyranids where they'll, you know, they'll just kind of nom on you in there. Now, when the tyranids take hold of a planet, they kind of finally takes good hold. Those kind of pustule looking, you know, formations on the ground, they open up and they reveal essentially a vat of acidic, you know, ooze that just collects and digests biomaterial. So any leftover bodies or anything that, you know, is left at the round that can be brought over and carried, they'll all be put into these digestive pits. The Ripper swarms will, or creatures like the Ripper swarms, they'll, you know, go around and they'll essentially, kind of like ticks, they'll go around and just find any bioorganic material and just eat until it's completely full. It doesn't digest anything. It just will eat until it's almost ready to explode. And then they will just crawl their way into a digestive pit and just plop themselves in. Feeding themselves with all of that bioorganic data into the digestive pit. And then all of this consumes into the surface. And then all of that then is consumed by all the tyranids on the planet. All bioorganic material essentially just kind of glassing itself onto the planet. And this is where I get into part of the thing about the Necrons again. Because this is the thing about it. Is they essentially glass the planet, right? Mm-hmm. But they're glassing the surface of the planet. Belisarius Call noted this and has very much surmised that it is actually probably possible with groundwater and all that to potentially honestly even be able to regrow life on planets. You know, take a few hundred years and whatnot, but that you could get a planet back to a livable status at some point after the tyranids have even gone through and consumed everything. Because they are only taking everything at surface level. So any of those tomb worlds or, you know, any of those tombs or, you know, crypts and stuff. Yeah, you know, again, any, like I said, any groundwater, stuff like that, anything that's below the surface, untouched. They are surface level bioorganic feeders. They are not looking deeper. They're not going to explode the planet. They just consume what is all taken and then move on.
Do they ever revisit worlds, or is there thing within the hive mind, mm-hmm, where they're able to determine that, like, oh, we sucked the resources from that world like 500 years ago, there's no need for us to revisit it?
Yeah, no, I mean, as the scout units go around, like, because generally, honestly, most of the time, especially with an Imperial world, it is, you know, it's an Imperial kind of note that once it's been taken by the Tyranids, it's just gone. They're not, mm-hmm, they don't, again, like many things with Call, they're not really willing to listen to the good, even when he has a good idea, they're not really willing to necessarily listen to him a lot of the time.
Right.
You know, he has to kind of get somebody to kind of vouch for the idea. But yeah, like for them, you know, they're going through and they will, you know, they'll see like, yeah, this has been dealt with. So this ain't it. Move on. And yeah, so like, from that, you know, yeah, like they'll know. But like, if they were to say fail their invasion, then they'll keep trying. You know, they're not going to stop. So if they fail their invasion, they'll give it a go again. And so yeah, so let's then kind of quickly just talk about some of the different high fleets that have been around. So the one thing that was always an initial thing is the first High Fleet in the first Tyrannic War right? The supposedly the Tyranids have been around for a long time, and maybe have like kind of, you know, and they've come out from somewhere outside of the Milky Way galaxy, right? Like they've come from somewhere. So, and there's some thoughts, right, in terms of like what drew them here. A lot of people say that it's the Astronomicon because of the Emperor's presence and all that, which is why, like, it, you know, it took until the 41st millennium to be found, you know? You know, they didn't, the first, you know, sighting and like contact wasn't until 40,745. So, like, kind of even pretty late in the 41st millennium, you know?
Okay.
And so, yeah, like the, you know, they, it was, and that, sorry. So, and that first contact actually was on an ocean world called Tyran or Tyran, hence why the Imperium just named them Tyranids. And that was with the High Fleet Behemoth, the one that was with Old One Eye, as mentioned earlier.
Old One Eye.
And they kind of went through this, the, I guess you could say, the eastern part of the galaxy, as it would be put on a map, somewhat near where the Tau Empire is. And that they've definitely, the Tau have definitely had their fair share of dealing with High Fleet Tyranid, or High Fleet Tyranid, High Fleet Behemoth, as did a number of Ultramarines, as it also led right towards Macragge. But many of the other Hive fleets also have come in. Kraken from, you know, from the same, somewhat same side. Moloch, Hydra coming from almost two different angles. And then the biggest one being Hive Fleet Leviathan. The most prominent one you'll see, the one that has the kind of purple and white color scheme that you generally see on Tyranid box art and stuff like that. They came from a completely different segment of the galaxy and have come in to just wreak havoc on a very, on various worlds. High Fleet Leviathan, the specific Tyranid fleet that is part of the Dawn of War 2 campaign, fun enough. But yeah, the different high fleets kind of all have their own various ways of dealing with them. You know, they are, sorry, I misspoke. All the different high fleets have their own ways of carrying through stuff. And generally, though, it all kind of comes to preferential things, right? Some maybe will use more lictors. Some will use more gene stealers. Some will use more melee weapons. Some will use more ranged weapons. That's kind of the difference between any of them. There's otherwise not a whole lot of distinction when it comes to the different high fleets, especially not in any way that I necessarily am wanting to go through now, because this episode generally will be long enough. So the Tyranids, as you could very much guess, is a horde army. You are going to be fielding a lot of models at one time. It is going to be the effective endless swarm in some respect or the other.
Does this make this one of the more expensive armies to cultivate?
In a sense, there's two benefits right now working for Tyranids, and that is that they are a part of all of the starter kit sets. And especially then if you have a friend that also is trying to collect Space Marines, this can come in handy. Especially if, for example, if you go into the either the starter set or the ultimate starter set, right? You know, you can get, you know, $112, you know, which obviously isn't a lot of money, you know, duh. But you're looking at that, right? You are not only getting like you know, a play mat, some dice, some, you know, nice little markers. But you're getting a full, you know, full set of Termagants and Hormagants that you could, my guess, kind of make either. Usually the Termagant and Hormagant kit are the same. You just pick which of the two you're going to build.
Mm-hmm.
But especially if your friend is a Space Marine collector, they're going to get, you know, normal troops and intercessors and some decent commanders. And in this case, the Usir's case, some Terminators, which are all good units to have for a Space Marine army. So you could conceptually get, you know, essentially, and because the starter set, for example, comes with the Psychophage, the two Termi Hormi combo, some, I think they're Von Ryan's Leapers, which is like a somewhat psychic kind of, you know, they're kind of like long, you know, they call them mantis-like hunters. They're kind of like they're a stealth unit as well. Yeah, here. So you're getting 27 models total. Some of which are decently expensive kits. Like the Psychophage is a brand new model, and so like it cost the, you know, the amount of a full unit and being $60. And honestly, I kind of was expecting it to be a little bit more than that.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, so you're getting, you're already getting like a, you know, two $50 kits, a $60 kit, another, you know, another like $30-$40 kit. And then another $60 kit on top of that. But you're getting all of that, you know, depending on if you get the ultimate starter set or not. You're getting that for like a quarter of the cost, even if you got the Space Marines. But then if you split it, it's even less, you know. Mm-hmm. You essentially, because if you got the starter set, which is $112, and you then bought, you know, you split it with a friend and they got all the Space Marine units and you got the Tyranid units. Yeah. Instead of spending close to $300, you're spending 60.
Yeah.
Like that's crazy good. Like that's a crazy good deal. And conceptually you could, but this is a box you could potentially get more than one of for both you and your friend at different times, you know, especially with the way these, a lot of these boxes are set up, you know, than that you kind of are given the benefit of being able to also just play with what you get in these boxes. So you could just like play games with the boxes you get, like the starter mm-hmm. set boxes, and then just build as you go, right? But that's the same argument for like combat and patrol and stuff, which they also have, which is all the stuff that does come in that starter set. But again, that costs $168 if you get the combat patrol. The only extra thing you're getting are some rippers and some barb gaunts, which are, you know, range only Tyranids. But the one benefit right now, I think they're going to be releasing them soon, but the one benefit to getting the combat patrol / the starter boxes is, or if you can go to a store and they have the Leviathan box still, that is essentially, if you split that with a friend, you each essentially pay $100 and you get half of an entire army.
Wow. Okay.
Which is stonks.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, the Termagants and the Hormagants got new sculpts with this update, because they were like the title faction, because every new edition of 40K the Space Marines fight somebody. So in 9th edition it was Necrons, and because of that, Necrons are still relatively affordable, because you'll find a lot of people who are selling other halves of previous boxes or whatnot. And then before that was the Death Guard in 8th edition. So 10th edition it was the Tyranids. And this is the second half of this, and what helps make it affordable now is I talked about it. Like, what if your friend got this box, right? What if you don't have a friend? Well, guess what? Somebody else doesn't have that friend either. And somebody else maybe plays Space Marines and wanted the Space Marine half of all these boxes, but doesn't have a friend that wants to play Tyranids. So they go to eBay or they go to Miniswap and they're like, hey, I have a Tyranid half of Leviathan that I want to sell. And you can probably get it for near or under $100. Mm-hmm. Or you sell the other half, right? Those are all things that you can do. And so there, what's nice about when a faction is the counter Space Marine faction in an edition of 40K is that they can get a lot of affordable units, which is incredibly helpful. Other than that, though, obviously, if you want to spread out and get, you know, a lot of the very unique models that aren't in those boxes, then yes, it can, you can start to run into some cost aspects. But it's kind of dependent on what your flavor is. That's kind of the nice part, is you can do those late. Sorry, you can do those later. You don't have to do them now. But you can dream about when you, you know, you want to get your Swarm Lord with his four swords for some reason.
Visions of Swarm Lords dancing in your head.
You know, or you can get your Neurothropes or, you know, a Broodlord or, you know, you can get some of the older models, maybe like your gargoyle brood and various other things. The one thing I will warn about with some of the models in Tyranids from the hobby and playing perspective is they really love to have a bunch of parts that overhang like the bases and whatnot.
Yeah.
Now, luckily, they had an in-game fix for this, because people who are dumb and love to be pricks in games and try to, you know, game rules and whatnot, of like line of sight rules and whatnot in their favor, would look at something like a Venom Throat and to be like, there's all these tentacles off the model, so you can't actually put them there, or I can see them because their tentacle is on the other side of this wall.
Oh, okay.
Just because, yeah, they have a lot of models that have these kind of overhanging bits, you know? Even, and so, like, luckily, GW fixed this recently. Now the rules generally state where it's just, it's based on the base. So if this hangs over, you know, if this hangs over something in cover, or, you know, like, is this is sticking into a wall or something like that, like a tendril or something, it's fine. Don't worry about it. As mm-hmm. long as the base fits, or they can see, or you can or can't see the base, you're good. However, one of the new units that came out recently was the Norn Emissary. This is kind of believed to be essentially kind of like an avatar unit for the Norn Queen.
Okay.
Essentially like the way for the Norn Queen to kind of have a physical presence on the battlefield. It's a fairly large model. This is your Space Marine for scale, which a Space Marine model, for your own reference, is about the size of your thumb in terms of height. Unless you have abnormally long thumbs. But if you have like a relatively average hand, yeah, it's about like the length of a thumb.
I'm taking and that secret to the grave.
And yes, I did double check with a Space Marine model that I have on my desk to compare what size part of my hand it is the closest to.
Doing the hard research.
And so yeah, this model is about, you know, double, like 2.3 times the size of a Space Marine. So it may be $118, but there's a reason. there's a lot of detail and plastic in it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like getting the good Gundams. I forgot, what are they called?
He means master grade.
That's what it's called. Though those naming schemes confuse me sometimes, because I'll think like one's higher than the other, and then it's like, no, that's lower.
Don't worry, I'll educate you on it someday.
Yeah, no, we'll learn.
We'll talk the differences between high grade and real grade and master grade and all that fun.
But yeah, but the Tyranids themselves, they play, like I said, like a horde army. But then part of that is, you know, they have a couple of their different play styles within that. So, you know, you can kind of run the big horde, or you can run a bunch of, you know, the monsters, generally called Monster Mash, which isn't necessarily the most popular. It's not the most competitive, viable way to play the Tyranids. And you might lose even more casual games than maybe you would like, but it's an option. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, there's very psychic-focused ones. So there's a decent way to play the Tyranids. And in terms of, you know, current way, and that's kind of the way that they always run into it, you know, like they will always kind of have your varying ways of playing them, right? Especially between what balance do you want of monsters, of, you know, between monsters or, you know, or big monsters or big hordes of tiny units, you know, or how much psychic versus, you know, not psychic warrior units do you want? Because it has this kind of decent range and option, you're not necessarily without choice in the matter, especially long term, you know, getting into future editions and changes. Mm-hmm. But other than that, any questions about the Tyranids?
No, kind of like what you said at the beginning, they're honestly fairly straightforward, you know.
They eat. They want to nom 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 your biomass.
They want to nom nom nom. They want to Gene Simmons give you a big old sloppy kiss, and they want to shoot you with guns made out of themselves.
Exactly. All right, well then that'll do it for this episode of Heretic Hammer. This will not be, I'll make this clear, this is not our last lore episode, but it's going to be, we're going to have a small break in some lore episodes. We're going to finally get into some of the hobby and game stuff now.
Ooh boy.
And those of you who do know the lore, like, but you're missing these factions. I know, but most of them are not factions that I would necessarily recommend starting outside, technically, in a way, maybe I wouldn't, but of Chaos Demons. But the reason I'm not going to talk about Chaos Demons now is because, like, or do a lore episode about it now is twofold. I want to figure out kind of a good way to set it up, because obviously that could take a really long time between the four gods. And we've kind of talked a lot about chaos overall, right? The varying levels of what chaos is. So when we get into the tabletop stuff, that's where we'll be able to talk a little bit more about, like, kind of what their demons are and do, because talking about them and how they work on the tabletop is very conducive to kind of relating it to their lore and without necessarily needing to go in a big deep dive. But that's not to say that it's not a possibility in the future. And then the other ones would be our knights. We are missing our knights and our Inquisition and are technically our Titans. However, I would not recommend starting with any of those armies.
Okay.
The I'll get into why when we talk about the hobby and like the gameplay, specifically when we talk into the game itself. But they're not ones I would ever recommend starting with. They're great second armies, but they're not for starting because they don't really teach you the game. And while I can't necessarily ever tell you to not, or I can't make you do anything, it's the best way I feel like that it's meant to set up. And it'll give us a nice break from some lore, and we can talk about, you know, hobbying, painting, building, you know, recommendations, things that I wish I knew when I was starting the game. And while this is a very lore-centric introduction to the game, now we are getting into the actual introduction to the game. So that'll be exciting, but that'll be next week. Talk about buying models. And Dylan, this is now your time to begin thinking. Because as I said from the top, there's going to be a point. It'll be on Tabletop Simulator, but there's going to be a point. Me and you are going to play a game of 40K. So I want you to start thinking in that noggin of yours. Out of all these factions we talked about so far, what do I want to take a swing at? You don't have to decide by next week, because the hobbying, learning about the hobbying do's and don'ts and stuff with some of these might sway your opinion. Even though, we'll be playing on TTS, so technically it doesn't matter, but you know what I mean. Just start cooking that in your mind. Because that time will come.
I'll definitely start. I definitely haven't already started weeks ago.
I mean, I imagine that was the case, but I just wanted to throw it out there.
Right. Everyone in the comments, put in your vote as to what faction you think I'm going to choose.
Prediction time.
Prediction time, baby.
All right. Otherwise, we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.